the first half of the book, chapter 4 and 5. In chapter 5, where is the Lamb? Standing beside the Father, being glorified and worshipped. The slain Lamb is alive and being worshipped. At the end of that first section, in chapter 11, where is the Lamb? For the throne, being praised, the victorious Christ. In chapter 12, beginning the second half of our book, the stage is set for what he's going to talk about in the last verse of chapter 12. Do you remember what it is? That's right. This dragon has been unsuccessful in devouring the child of that woman and keeping the child from being enthroned in heaven. He's lost the battle in heaven. He's been thrown out. So in wrath, he says, okay, I'll go make war with the descendants or the seed of the woman. And he tells us in 12:17 who that is. That is the bondservants of God or saints. So that sets the stage. In chapter 13, talks about two things the dragon employs. You remember what they are? The beast out of the sea and the beast out of the earth. All right, and so that's in chapter 13. And so we see this effort that the dragon is making to overcome the saints and the means that he's using. Now back in chapter 7, we saw 144,000 who were sealed, but they were on the earth. When you get to chapter 14, we see 144,000. Where are they? They're before the throne, aren't they? They're victorious. Okay, and now, in chapter 15, we are prepared for chapter 16. Chapter 15 introduces what? That prepares us for 16. Seven angels with seven bowls of wrath or seven plagues. And that's what is recounted beginning in chapter 16. Now, in chapter 15, and, well, let me go to chapter 16 because it's so clear. The seven bowls of wrath, according to chapter 16, verse 5 through 7. We talked about this a class or two ago. What do the seven bowls of wrath represent? According to 16, 5 through 7. If you're marking your Bible, it'll jump right out at you. We talked about a family of words to mark. And if you mark them in this section, they'll be right there.
Judgment.
The judgment family of words. That's right. And you see in verse 5, because you judged these things, why is this judgment rendered? Note verse 6, the first word, for. For what reason? Why is this judgment rendered? Why are these bowls of wrath being poured forth? Because the persecution of the saints. Right. And so that's what in chapter 6 the saints are praying about. That's what you have in chapter 8 the saints are praying about. And here you have these bowls of wrath, God in answer to their prayers in this picture, judging them. And you see in verse 7 at the end, true and righteous are your judgments. All right, now we're in chapter 17. You'll note at the head of the lesson, we have the title for this section, 17, 18, 19, and 20, Judgment on the Harlot, the Beast, and Satan. What I'm going to try to do, because our time is limited, is give us somewhat of a bird's eye view of this section, try to get the idea of this section rather than concentrate on the particulars. First of all, you'll note the woman, chapter 17, verse 1. And we ask you the question, what does the angel tell John he will show him? The answer is in 17 and 1. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and spoke with me, saying, "Come here, and I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters. I will show you," we have been talking about this being like a play or a movie. And so here's some more scenes that John will be allowed to see. And so what's he going to show him? Judgment on the great harlot. If you mark this section, and we suggested some markings for you in this section, again, I don't know if you like to study that way, but if you did mark those words throughout your Bible, then you will see the word harlot occurring over and over through this section. So we have in the lesson judgment on the harlot, and that's exactly what you have in verse 1, the judgment of the great harlot. All right? Now then, you notice we have judgment on the beast. And if you look down here at verse 3, the harlot is sitting on what? A scarlet beast. Down in verse 7, what's the relationship? That's on your questions here. What is the relationship between the harlot and the beast? The beast is carrying her. She's sitting on the beast. There's definitely a connection then between the harlot and the beast. And so again, if you mark that throughout this section, you see this woman pictured as a harlot, and then she's sitting on this terrible beast that was introduced back in chapter 13. Okay? Now then, what about we got here the harlot, the beast, and Satan. Now I go over, if you will, to chapter 20 and verse 2. While 17 and 18 and 19 doesn't tell you, or doesn't mention Satan, you know from previous chapters that the beast and the false prophet are at his bidding. The woman, the harlot, is sitting on the beast. And now we have in chapter 20 and verse 2, this angel coming down from heaven, holding the key of the abyss and a great chain in his hand, and he laid hold of the dragon, the serpent of old, who is called the devil and Satan. And so now we have the devil and Satan, and here he's bound for 1,000 years, and then a little bit further on, he's released for a time, verse 7, but then judgment is brought upon him, and down in verse 10, the devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are also. So, in one word, how would you describe verse 10 relative to Satan? One word.
Judged.
So you see the title to our section? Judgment on the harlot, the beast, and Satan. That's what these four chapters are about. Okay? Now, when we finish this section, and I don't know if we will tonight, what I'm hoping that we will see is just what John prayed, led us in prayer about. That is, that in the judgment that God renders on the woman, the beast, and Satan, saints are assured of their victory. These saints that are being written to, they don't go to church in fine air-conditioned chariots. They don't sit in a nice building without fear of oppression. They don't go home throughout the week and not worry. These saints may have a knock on the door, somebody threatening to throw them in jail. Some of these saints are crying because their loved one has been killed by the authorities. They've lost loved ones. Some are in prison, more are going to prison. Life is difficult. There are those who are saying, "You've made a mistake embracing Christianity. We're the people of God. We're the real Jews." Did they make a mistake? Did they embrace the right religion when they became Christians? "But we believe in Jesus." Where is he? Why don't he do something for you? He died 30, 40 years ago. Where is he? and thus the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation has some pretty marvelous scenes. Incredible almost. Would you build your faith in the victory of saints by starting in the book of Revelation? Absolutely not. If you want to build your faith in the truth of the good news about Jesus, where do you start? The Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But once that's confirmed, and that's further confirmed in the 30 years that's recorded in the book of Acts, now John is an apostle of that one. As he writes this letter, you can have confidence in it. You don't have confidence in it because you read it in Revelation. You have confidence in it because of the truth being confirmed by the Gospels. And so it's important we approach that in the right order to be sure that we understand that we can have confidence in the things that are recorded. All right. Now we have here judgment on the woman. And I have here on your lesson, C, chapter 17, 16. Note verse 17, 16. What's going to happen to the woman? Right now she's beautiful. She's decked out, it says in verse 3. She's sitting on a scarlet beast. Verse 4, she's got these beautiful clothes on. She's got gold and precious stones and pearls. I mean, she looks like she's living the life of luxury and power and victory. She's riding on this ferocious beast, this fearsome beast. But what does it say in verse 16 awaits her? All right? She's going to be made desolate and naked. All of those pretty clothes and all of that jewelry and all that she uses to appeal to get her people to be involved with her immorality. And then, as it was stated in somewhat in the class, she'll be burned up with fire. That's judgment. That's destruction. So here's the picture that seems like a picture of victory and power and glory. But here's her end. Look down at 18, verse 8. For this reason, one day her plagues will come, pestilence and mourning and famine, and she'll be burned up with fire, for the Lord who judges her is strong. And the kings of the earth who committed acts of immorality and lived sensuously with her will weep and lament over her when they see the smoke of her burning, standing at a distance because of the fear of her torment, saying, "Woe, woe, the great city, Babylon, the strong city, for in 1 hour your judgment has come." What I want you to see, though, is this judgment on this beast. We'll come back to that verse in a little bit. So you see here in 8 through 10, she is Babylon, the great city. Over and over again, she's called Babylon, the great city. So the woman is not a literal woman. The city of Babylon, whatever that represents, is likened to a woman, and it's not the literal Babylon of old. But so much of Revelation is rooted in the Old Testament, and so that judgment on that city would be very vivid, and that's used to refer to judgment on this great city. Okay, and we studied chapter 11, verse 8. In 11:8, the great city is identified. What is it? Jerusalem. Understand, not everybody will agree that Babylon, the great city, in 17 through 20 is talking about Jerusalem. Many will take it to be Rome. And if you do, that's okay. The lesson is unchanged. But if 11:8 identifies it, it sure seems to be Jerusalem. Either way, the lesson is the same. Judgment on the harlot, the great city, who seems to rejoice in the fact of the victory that she has over the saints. In 19, 2 and 3, look at 19, 2 and 3. His judgments are true and righteous, for he's judged. Note that word judge over and over again. That's what this section is about. He's judged the great harlot who is corrupting the earth with her immorality. And when he judged the harlot, what does this verse say that did?
Avenged
what? The blood of the martyrs, those who held their faith and were put to death. We're going to look back at chapter 17 in just a minute and see how that fits together. So the woman is judged. All right, now she's a harlot, great city. We put on your lesson to read about Babylon and Tyre. I don't know if you did that or not. We're not going to have time. Tyre is likened unto a harlot, the ancient city of Tyre. Say, why is Tyre likened unto a harlot? You'll have to go back and read Isaiah 23. Tyre is likened unto a harlot because she sells herself for wages. That's what a harlot does. And so that's the picture back there she was a city of commerce, business. Then you have Nineveh. Nahum chapter 3 and verse 4 is likened unto a harlot. And the reason it's likened unto a harlot is because she seduces the nations for her own ends. That's what a harlot does. She's very selfish, and she'll use her beauty, her wealth, and her means to accomplish her own ends. And so Nineveh is likened unto a harlot for that reason. And then Israel in Ezekiel 23:30 is likened unto a harlot. And there it's because she practiced idolatry. As a harlot's not true to her husband, Israel was not true to her husband, to God. And I mention all of those for this simple reason. Cities, sometimes nations like Israel, are likened unto a woman, a harlot. What is the point? You have to look at the context of the verse. You cannot arbitrarily assign a reason why a city or a nation is likened to a harlot. And so we know that Babylon, the great city, whether this is Jerusalem or Rome, is likened unto a harlot in our text. That's very clear. Why? So let's look at the context. Look at 17 verse 2. It says, the kings of the earth and those who dwell on the earth. Verse 2. Drop down to verse 8 with me just a moment. We have an identifying characteristic about those who dwell on the earth. It's not simply talking about geography. Verse 8, if you want to use the term earth dwellers, we talked about this in a previous chapter, about those who dwell in heaven, not necessarily talking about geography, but heaven dwellers. They were associated with God in the tabernacle. But here are those who dwell on the earth, verse 8. Did Christians dwell on the earth at this time? Yes, but they're not included in this group. Who are the people who dwell on the earth according to verse 8? Those whose names are not in the book of life. The kings of the earth and those who dwell on the earth are in alliance with this harlot and this beast. And their war against the saints. Look at verse 14 of chapter 17. How are we using this verse? The theme of the letter, isn't it? This is what it's about. They make war against the Lamb. And so you have the kings of the earth, those who dwell on the earth, and it says they were drunk. That's the imagery. They're drunk with wine. The wine of her, it says, immorality. Now, when we think of immorality, we may think of actual sensual sin. But is that the idea here? Watch. Now he says in verse 4, the woman was clothed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls. What's she have in her hand? A cup. A gold cup. Now think about drunk and a gold cup. And the cup was full of abominations and the unclean things of her immorality. whatever the immorality is, it's represented by the wine in the cup. Now, the kings of the earth and those who dwell on it are drunk with the wine in the cup. Now, go down to verse 6. What is the wine in the cup according to verse 6? That makes the kings and the people of the earth and her drunk. The blood of the saints. So here's this ferocious beast out to overcome the saints, to kill the saints, to imprison the saints, and they're martyrs. She's delighted. She gets drunk with their blood. Good grief. Is that a picture of victory? Do you want to be one of those people? One of those Christians? Doesn't look very good, does it? She doesn't just imbibe a little bit. She's drunk with the blood of the saints. That's the picture that's presented. And so, it says, with the blood of the witnesses of Jesus. Look at 18:24. That's expanded. 18:24. Besides the blood of the saints that were martyred here in the first century, what's it expanded to? Of all the who have been slain on the earth. Blood of the prophets and of the saints, all who have been slain on the earth. Hold your finger here at 17 and 18 just a moment. Go back to Matthew 23. We've not made an issue out of whether this was written in the 60s or the 90s, whether it refers primarily to Jerusalem or Rome. But I am showing you some reasons why I favor Jerusalem and why this seems to make a lot of sense to me. Look in chapter 23 and verse 34. Jesus is speaking to the rulers of Jerusalem, scribes and the Pharisees. And they're the representatives of Judaism at that time. Jerusalem is their capital. Look what he says in 34. Behold, I'm sending you prophets and wise men and scribes. Some of them you will kill and crucify, and some of them you will scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city. Did that happen? Where is it recorded? Book of Acts, next 30 years. But now look, so that upon you may fall the guilt of all the righteous blood shed on the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. Truly I say to you, all these things will come upon what? This generation. You go into chapter 24. And he starts talking about what's going to happen to the city and to the temple. And then you get to chapter 24. And in verse 34, what does he say about all those things he's talking about? This generation will not pass away till all these things take place. This is the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. Daniel talks about judgment upon God's people and his indignation being finished. They were warned about it in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 28-29. Jesus preached about it in chapter 10 of the book of Revelation, in verse 7. Then the mystery of God is finished, as he preached to his servants the prophets. Jesus' ministry was to the Jews, wasn't it? For 3 years he preached. What good did it do? Who nailed him to a cross? The Jews. He sent out his apostles. Where'd they go first? To the Jews. Who stoned Stephen? Jews. And who imprisoned the apostles? The Jews. who persecuted the Christians so badly they had to leave their hometown. Acts 8. Saul. What was he? He was a Jew, wasn't he? Had the support of the Jews. And so now, this has been going on. And whether you take it to be in the 60s or the 90s, it's been going on for either 30 plus years or 50 plus years. God said judgment's coming. He knows what's happening. He's going to render judgment on the great harlot who seems so beautiful and free of cares. No, your end is devastation. And so that's the picture that's being presented. Okay, and so back in chapter 17, verse 18, is there any doubt left about who the woman represents based on that verse? Who is she? 17, 18. The great city. Do you have marked out in your margin chapter 11, verse 8? Identifies the great city. So she's the great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. You say, how could Jerusalem reign over Rome? Not reigns in the sense of power and dominion, but through her immorality. She used Rome for her purposes. Did she? Was Jerusalem able to kill the Messiah? No. What did they have to do? They had to get Pilate to kill an innocent man, declared innocent four times, but they did it. And so, here's the woman, the great city, it says. And so, we read in chapter 6, verse 9 through 11, that's what they're praying about. We read in chapter 8, that's what they're praying about. In chapter 15, in the preparation for the seven bowls of wrath, in verse 5 through 7, we went through that pretty rapidly. But when you go back to chapter 15, you have these people singing the song of Moses, the song of the Lamb. What kind of song would that be? What? Victory song. It's the song of overcomers, verse 2. Victors. And their victory has been accomplished, verse 4, through his righteous acts. And now you look in verse 5 following. You have the seven angels with the seven plagues, or the seven bowls of wrath. The bowls of wrath are the wrath of Almighty God. Look at verse 1. In them the wrath of God is finished. And through his righteous acts in judging their enemies, they're singing praise, praise of victory. They overcame. Egypt was going to destroy Israel, but they couldn't. Most powerful nation on earth. They're delivered through the Red Sea. And they sing the song of Moses and the Lamb. Not by their own power. Now they're singing the song of the Lamb. How are they going to overcome all this great beast? And this other beast that gets them to worship the first beast. How in the world can they ever win the battle? They're going to win it. And they're singing this song of victory. And that's the picture that's presented. Okay. I simply say this, that there's other indications to me that this is Jerusalem, but we'll not spend time on that. I will say that different people make the woman equal Rome, and those who make, and I'm talking about gospel preachers who've written commentaries. We're not talking about premillennialists. They make all kinds of things out of it. But those who make the woman Rome, some will make the beast the civil power of Rome. Some will make the beast the world Roman Empire. Some will make the beast the political Roman Empire. And these are all very capable men. I'm just saying they're, what I'm saying is, when you start trying to pin it down to something like that, there's really nothing in the text that allow you to do that. You have to get the concept. That's what we're trying to work on, is what concept is being presented. Okay. Yes.
Here in chapter 17, are the 10 kings, are they literal, or are they part of the picture? You know, it says the 10 horns are, you know, are 10 kings.
Okay, look at chapter 17. Beginning in verse 9. This beast has seven heads. He says the seven heads are seven mountains. Mountains throughout Old Testament history used to represent seats of government. There are seven mountains. What are the seven mountains, verse 10? Seven kings. Five are fallen, one is, the other's not yet come. There's five, six, seven. Then you have verse 11, there's an eighth. The beast, which was and is not, is himself also an eighth. So now you have eight. Now who are those seven kings? And then in verse 12, you have 10 horns. What do they represent? 10 kings. And yet then he says, well, they've not received a kingdom. They've not received dominion like these other kings, but they have some kind of authority as kings, verse 12, for a short time, for an hour, 1 hour. What's all that about? When I was studying the book of Revelation, and I tried to see, try to learn from others, and so I looked at fellows who believed it was talking about Rome. Some thought it was talking about Jerusalem. Trying to see, what do they do with this? For example, one fella, and I've got a list here in my Bible that I'll not go through, but I've got a list here of 12 emperors, starting with Julius Caesar. One fellow, the way he numbers them, the number 8 is I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it right, Vitalius, 69 A.D. That's his number 8. And this fellow's a very capable man, a historian, Bible, not a member of the church, but a very capable writer. Second fellow, who's a gospel preacher, written some excellent works, a fellow by the name of McGuigan, he makes number 8, Domitian. According to the first fellow, Domitian's number 11. Well, he numbers them. Then there's a third one I've got here, a fellow named Ogden, also was a gospel preacher. He believed he was talking about Jerusalem. The way he totaled it up, number 8 is Titus. Which one is it? How do you know? And each one will make their arguments for which it is. What I suggest to you, as you look at these, I think I've got a question on here somewhere. If I can find it, about this. Where's my question about what these kings represent? Oh, here they are. The beast has seven heads and 10 horns. What do these represent? If they're one of the Roman emperors, you're going to have to ask somebody else which one it is, okay? What I'm simply suggesting, what does the number 10 throughout the book suggest? Complete, strong, and the number 7, perfected. So here is the idea of a civil power that is strong and perfected as it persecutes and kills the saints. Now note verse 13, here's something you can hang your hat on. Whatever they are, verse 13, what does it say about them in verse 13? They have one purpose. From your reading of the book of Revelation, reading 17 through 20, what is their one purpose? Kill the saints, persecute the saints. We talk about the beast, for example, back in chapter 11. Verse 7, the beast that comes out of the abyss will make war with them and overcome them and kill them. That's what the beast's purpose is. If they have one purpose, is that not the purpose of the other beast and of the woman? Is that not the purpose of all these kings? If they have one purpose, I know that was the purpose of the beast. Back in chapter 13, verse 1, the beast that came out of the sea, Look down in 13, verse 7. What does he come out of the sea to do? Make war with the saints. To overcome them. And you read in verse 10, some are killed with the sword. Some are taken to captivity. And then in chapter 15, in verse 2, here you have the beast. They've been victorious over the beast. Look in chapter 20 and verse 4. These people that are victorious over the beast are pictures of what kind of people in 20 and 4?
Martyrs.
Martyrs. They have one purpose. We're going to make you deny your faith. We're going to make you leave Christianity. You had that first beast that used persecution. He then had a second beast, the false prophet beast. And he's going to use fear. And he's going to use false signs. And he used economic oppression to try to deceive you that your religion is not valid and cause you to give up your faith. But all through the book, the admonition is to be faithful unto death, even in the face of death. And so that's the war that's going on in the book. I can't identify personally these seven kings, ten kings, as far as what Roman emperors, if that's what it is. You'll have to, again, ask somebody else about that. What you can do is choose which commentary you like and pick that one, I guess. But I know what the general picture is. I know what the lesson is. There's this massive war. Satan's the brains behind it. Satan's the motivation behind it. And he's making war 12:17. He's making war on the saints. And he wants to overcome them. But he's going to lose the battle. Because of 17:14. The King of Kings and Lord of Lords is going to overcome him. That's our theme. And those who are with him will overcome as well. Okay. Now they've got this harlot that's being pictured. This woman dressed in all these beautiful clothes and necklaces, and it looks like she's so powerful, but she's drunk with the wine of the blood of the saints. But you have another woman introduced in chapter 19, verse 7. Who is this woman? The wife, the bride of the Lamb. And his bride has made herself ready, given to her to clothe herself in fine linen, bright and clean. What does that represent? It says the fine linen is the righteous acts of the saints. Then he said to me, write, blessed are those who are invited to the marriage supper of the Lamb. And he said to me, these are the true words of God. Now, if you're in the first century, which woman do you want to be associated with? The harlot or this other woman? See? But this other woman represents the righteous acts of the saints. And they will have a wedding with the Lamb. That is this woman. They're pictured as a woman. Whole corporate body pictured as a woman. You can see the contrast between the harlot and this other woman in this particular text. Okay, now, we've talked about the beast. We look at 19:11 through 21. We're talking about this beast. So you got the harlot, the beast, and Satan. And 19:11 through 21, it reaches a pinnacle, as it were. Back in chapter 16:16, we had such a thing. It was called the War of what? Armageddon. And if that's talking about the Valley of Jezreel, that's where decisive battles took place. It's the only time it occurs in the Bible. And you remember we compared those seven bowls of wrath with back in chapter 7. And back there, you remember that. And one of them, at the river Euphrates, the angel released this terrific army, made war on the saints. And so this army comes to battle now. This battle is waged. All right, so you have this picture here again in 19:11. I saw heaven open, behold, a white horse. And he who sat on it is called Faithful and True. And in righteousness he judges and wages war. Is this judging and waging war in the sense of converting people? No. Nowhere in the context. That's not this kind of judging. Not this kind of war. His eyes are a flame of fire, and his head are many diadems. He has a name written on him which no one knows except himself. He's beyond description in his majesty and glory. His clothes are robe dipped in blood. His name is called the Word of God. So now he's identified. Who wrote Revelation? Who wrote the Gospel of John? How did John begin the Gospel of John? The beginning was the Word. The Word was God. And verse 14, what happened to the Word? Became flesh. And so, that's that Word. And in 1 John 1, he talks about he's the Word of life, doesn't he? So he's the Word of God. The armies which are in heaven, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, were following him on white horses. So here's this majestic, indescribable being with eyes like a flame and crowned on his head, and he got this army following him. And it says, from his mouth comes a sharp sword, and with it he may strike down the nations, and he'll rule them with a rod of iron. And he treads the winepress of the fierce wrath of God the Almighty. That's a picture of judgment that you find in the Old Testament of God's divine wrath being exercised upon nations. And on his robe and on his thigh he has a name written. King of kings and Lord of lords. It didn't make any difference how powerful the emperor was. This one has dominion over him. Makes no difference how powerful the Jewish civil authorities were. The Sanhedrin was. It makes no difference. He's King of kings and Lord of lords. And I saw an angel standing in the sun and cried out with a loud voice, saying to all the birds which fly in the heaven, come assemble for the great supper of God. What is the supper? All you birds, come eat this big supper we got for you. What is it? That's right, all those decaying corpses. They lost the battle and there their bodies lay. Come on, birds, eat all these big kings and rulers. They could win this battle with the King of kings and Lord of lords. And that's the picture that's being presented. And so the participants, you have the participants in this battle. You note down in verse 19, you have the beast, the kings of the earth, and their armies. That's on one side. And they make war. They make war against him who sat on the throne and against his army. So here's the beast. Remember him described back in chapter 13? Ferocious. And then you have the kings of the earth. You think, well, man, they're powerful. And then you have their armies. But on the other side, this one on the white horse, and those who follow him. And the beast was seized, and with him the false prophet who performed the signs in his presence by which he deceived. Remember, we read about the two beasts. First beast, the second beast. The second beast is called the false prophet. Used deception. Those who received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image, these two were thrown alive into the lake of fire which burned with brimstone. It's the idea of destruction. Decisive defeat. The rest were killed with the sword which came from the mouth of him who sat on the horse, and all the birds were filled with their flesh. Just get the idea of the big picture. That's what's being painted here in chapter 17 through 20. All right, we'll start with chapter 20 right here with Satan. The Lord willing, in our next class,